Well, thank you very much, and it's very good to see everybody. I'd like to begin by saying thank you. Thank you, first of all, to Jean-Luc and Yadi for your leadership and for making this project possible, and to Jean-Michel and your team for opening the opportunity. This is an opportunity we've been waiting for a long time, and I think it only happens when individuals are able to see the possibility and show the leadership, and we're very grateful to you for doing that. And we should also recognise, I think, the staff in Yadi, particularly Thomas Lowell and Charlotte. Heck, Charlotte, I think, is still standing outside, but Thomas, please make sure that she knows that we appreciate what she has done to prepare this project. I like, when I go to a conference, you know, to understand what the exam question is, so that at the end of the day, I can ask myself, have I answered it or not? And I want to spend part of my time today seeing whether I can help to formulate the exam question that will run through this project and which links these different work streams on new actors, on climate change, and on energy. And the argument I want to make has three steps in it. The first is that European Development Cooperation has been on a journey, but this will continue. I'll say something about that. I want to say something about the big challenges of the next decade, which frame the work we're going to do together. And I want to say something finally about research policy partnerships, the partnership between us and researchers and Jean-Michel and your colleagues as policymakers, and how we make that work. Let's start with the point at which the European Development Cooperation project has gone. And I think we need to recognise, especially those of us who have occasionally been critical of some of the aspects of European Development Cooperation, we need to recognise how far the project has come, especially in the last decade. The formation of EuropeAid, the development policy statement, a single statement by all the European member states on their objectives in international development. The deconcentration and empowerment of field offices in the European system. The code of conduct, which tries to work out how different European member states can work together at country level. Work on coherence. The financial perspectives to 2013, which kind of lay out the money available for the future. Work that's been done on the common foreign and security policy, and of course the Lisbon Treaty when it's finally approved. Ratified, which will create for the first time a common external action service. I described it as an infrastructure fit for purpose, almost, and almost for two reasons. First, because we know that on this whole list of issues, there is still work to be done, especially on coherence, on the implementation of the CFSP, and the code of conduct, which in some respects is kind of an ambition rather than a reality. But also there's still an outstanding reform agenda, the Commission structure following the appointment of the new Commission next year, the relationship between the budget and the EDF, the final stages of introducing economic partnership agreements, and issues about the future of the regional groupings, particularly to my mind the ACP. This is an ongoing process. But we're a lot further on than we were in the days when our development minister in the UK, Clare Short, used to stand up and demand that the money be taken back from Brussels and routed through the bilateral programme. So that's good. But as we think about the future of international development, I think it's fair to say that we've been dominated by thinking on the MDGs for many years. And the MDGs still remain very important. We have that topic on the European Council agenda in June and the MDG Call to Action Summit in September in New York. But sometimes when you focus very intensively on one issue, you can miss the things that are going on around you. And I imagine that some of you in this room have been to an African game park to look at the animals. Please put up your hand if you've been to an African game park. A quarter. For those of you who haven't done it, let me explain that you get up before dawn and you drive around the savannah looking usually for the lions, and you're very excited, you find the lion, there she is, with her, the lioness, with her cubs, and the wildebeest that killed, and everybody in the car sits there looking out at the lion, and then sometimes behind you there is a very large elephant, but you haven't noticed because you're facing the wrong way. And what I want to talk a little bit about is the elephant behind us. As we do that, we will come back to Winston Churchill, who said at a certain point in the Second World War, you know, this is not the end, this is not the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. And I think the point which we are with development cooperation in Europe, having done this work, is now given ourselves almost the infrastructure to begin to address the new questions. And it's how we address the new questions and how we put together the right coalitions in Europe that forms the guiding issue that this project is going to address. So there's one elephant, and there's another elephant. What are these new issues that we need to be thinking about? I think there are three. And actually, although this is from a different lecture about the future of Europe, the three issues that we've chosen for EDP 2020 fit quite well with the new agenda. The first, of course, is that we face a very different world with the emergence of China and India. China alone has doubled the labor-to-capital ratio in the world. It has led to the commoditization of manufacturing prices and driven them down. It has driven natural resource prices up. India is in the same game. India, I see, by the way, in the next few weeks, is going to be announcing the creation of its own aid agency. This is a country that receives, I think, £300 million a year in aid from the UK government. We'll have its own aid agency by the end of the year. There are new actors that are changing the way in which development works, we know that. The second is the issue about security, and we've chosen to look at energy. We could have chosen other securities. Clearly we could have chosen the war on terror as an issue. We could have looked at water security as an issue. Of course, food security is very much on the agenda this week with the summit in Rome. That question of what thinking about security does for our thinking about development. Who are the principal players in Brussels and in our capitals on that, on those topics? How do they work together? And finally, there is a shift in thinking in development from worrying about NDGs at country level, national poverty reduction strategies, to thinking about global public goods. And climate change is the obvious one, but there are many others, including financial insecurity. The credit crunch is an example of these new global issues which are driving the way we think about development. Put these three together, and they represent an enormous challenge to our traditional way of thinking about development. Your traditional aid agency, which specializes in running rural development projects in remote parts of African countries, is not the answer to this set of problems. The aid agency, which mainly provides technical cooperation to central government, is not the answer to this kind of question. And our development minister in the UK, Douglas Alexander, has said he wants to change the FID from being an aid agency to a development ministry. A ministry concerned not just with delivering good projects and good budget support to poor countries and to delivering the MDGs, but a ministry which is able to tackle this complex set of interrelated diplomatic, military, foreign policy problems, as well as aid problems across a whole range of different sectors. In separate streams of work at ODI, we're also looking at the question, that means entirely different kinds of people in these ministries. You know, don't go and study agricultural economics, like most of us did. Go and study foreign policy and how to broker global deals. Become an expert in how the UN works. Become an expert in how to get things done in Brussels. That's the future of international development in this new world, not necessarily knowing about the details that we commonly work on. There are big changes underfoot. And I think people entering the profession at this stage in the world will come out with a very different career pattern to those of us who went in the 1970s and 80s. Now, many people are working on changes in the world and the way in which new global risks and opportunities define the development agenda for the future. This is taken from work by the World Economic Forum on global risks. Nobody ever produces a report, I've noticed, called Global Opportunities 2007. I think that would be an interesting challenge for somebody to fund, actually. Global Opportunities 2007. What is the greatest probability of success? What is the greatest benefit to the world? And let's map opportunities in the same way as we map risks. Eliminating malaria, or providing HIV/AIDS treatment, or primary education. Many other opportunities. And we live at a time when, by certainly the middle of the next decade, most poor people in the world will live in middle-income countries. India will be a middle-income country by 2013 at the latest, even earlier if the current growth rate continues. And that also poses a very interesting set of challenges for us. But this is about risk. This is a mapping of probability against impact of different risks, and it just sort of illustrates, and I know you can't read it, but the kind of things we should be worrying about. Asset price collapses, Middle East instability, destabilization of the world economy because of a fall in the dollar, big conflict issues, avian flu and other disease outbreaks. People who are thinking about how we manage our global community are worrying about these kinds of things. And many of these are on the agenda of development ministries. But you know what? Many of them are not on the agenda of development ministries and should be. And part of what we want to do in this project, I think, is to make sure we are thinking about the management of the world global commons as well as thinking about how to deliver aid in support of the NDC. So to summarise my point here, I think that the main lesson we have is that the new development agenda occurs at the interface where aid, foreign policy and trade meet. You know, in another lecture I show a school atlas map of the Horn of Africa. Ethiopia, Somalia, Eritrea, Sudan, Chad, Rwanda, DRC, and the question I always ask is, put your hands up if you think, this is a rhetorical question, put your hands up if you think that we solve the problems of the Horn of Africa simply by investing in primary healthcare and primary education. And of course the answer is you don't. The answer is you need an integrated, joined up policy which is going to deliver political, military, diplomatic and aid solutions to the very complex problems of franchising. Development will be different in the future. European development will be different in the future, and one of the arguments I make in other places is that actually Europe has particular comparative advantage over national governments in dealing with these complicated problems. Europe has a structure of political relationships with countries, especially through the joint ministerial councils and the joint parliamentary assemblies, and the accountability is built into Cotonou. Europe has the potential to link the common foreign and security policy and aid and trade in ways that many other development agencies don't. Europe has a comparative advantage in dealing with the new and more complex development agenda. Now, that leads us then to the exam question, which I think runs through our three topics on energy and on climate change and on new actors. And the question is really, will there be a European comparative advantage? How do we realise the potential comparative advantage? And what should be the reform agenda? And we ask that question about the values, the policies, the structures, the programmes, and the implementation of European development cooperation. And in doing all those things, we ask some positive questions about how things work, and we ask some normative questions about how we might change things in order to make them work better. There's a strong statement of values, which I haven't put on a PowerPoint here, at the beginning of the Lisbon Treaty. Is that right? How did it come about that this list of words appears in Article 1 of the Lisbon Treaty? Who wants what kind of words? How do we set the basic framework? And so on, all the way through this structure. Values, policies, structures, programs, implementation. How does the European project happen? That is really the exam question that we need to deal with. And we take three different lenses to look at it, a climate change lens, an energy security lens, and a new actors lens. But those are the core issues that we deal with. Now, when we last did this for European Development Cooperation to 2010, we used the technique of scenario planning to identify four possible futures for European Development Cooperation. We said there were two drivers, and I'm not saying that I would do this the same way today if I had to do it today, but we had at the time these two drivers. The first was whether or not there was a commitment to work together or whether we would retreat to be nation states. Always that tension exists, certainly in my country, I'm sure in many of yours, about Europe, a tension between how committed we are and why we are committed in different ways to this European project. And the second is whether we thought that development cooperation was genuinely informed by poverty objectives, or whether it was informed by something more mercenary or perhaps anyway different. We're interested in all countries for different kinds of reasons, and the question is what the balance is between them. And you can see that if you put this on a 2x2 matrix, you get four possible outcomes. We gave those names, and we revealed our ideological preference in giving them names. We talked about the top right-hand corner as progression, where we were strongly committed to a European set of solutions, and there was a strong focus on poverty reduction. And then we called the others by different names, which we had a lot of trouble finding rhymes, but anyway, progression, compression, secession, retrogression, to try and capture the idea that these four possible outcomes would take us in different directions. Top right-hand corner, pro-Europe, pro-poverty reduction. But the implication for Europe, if we were still committed to poverty reduction, but less interested in the collective action problem in Europe and retreated to nation states, was compression. If we went for a Europe that was less pro-poor, that would be a backward step. And we thought that if the movement was towards less poverty focus and back to the nation states, then people would simply leave. They would walk away from the European project. Of course, not legally, but in terms of enthusiasm and commitment and people and money. One of the jobs we need to do in this project, and we might come back to it during the course of the day, is whether this captures the problem. Does this scenario exercise, which is now 4 or 5 years old, I suppose, still capture the kind of choices we're making, and can we then start to map for these different topics the outcomes which seem most likely and most desirable? The positive question and the normative question. Now, let me conclude with a couple of slides about what it means to undertake a policy research project. We know what policymakers think of researchers. It is not a very flattering picture that policymakers carry in their heads. We are slow. We never deliver on time. We never use 10 words where 20 pages would do. We write too much. We talk too much. We're unable to generate useful policy recommendations within the time frame that policymakers need. We know what researchers think about policymakers, but perhaps I won't risk my future by telling you about that. And so part of our work at ODI and many of the other ERB research institutes has been to think about how researchers need to behave differently. And I put this up really to speak to the researchers in the room. We think that there are four things researchers need to be able to do, and there's of course a literature on all of these, and we have a research program on the subject. The first is to be able to tell a good story. That is Scheherazade sitting up on the right, who charmed the Sultan and saved her life by doing so. Stories have a beginning, a middle, an end. They give policymakers options. They are written in one page and not 500 pages. They arrive at the time when you need them, like when you're about to go to sleep, your bedtime story. We need to be much better storytellers. We see this a lot this year with issues like the food crisis. When the BBC ring me up, they don't want me to give them a 200-page dissertation on food. They want me to tell them in not more than 90 seconds what the five solutions are to the world food crisis. The second is that we need to be very good networkers. Researchers need to know who the policymakers are who are making the decisions. They need to be able to put the messages in the right place at the right time. They only do that if they've invested in building the networks. Who does the minister's advisor ring up when they want a solution to a problem? And if they don't ring ERB, then we have a problem. We need to make sure we know who the minister's advisors are. We need their telephone numbers on our telephones. We need a constant email traffic. We need meetings and lunches and dinners. We need to be practical. That's a picture of Isambard Kingdom Brunel, the famous engineer who developed new technology but did it by doing it and not by simply writing academic papers about it. And finally, we need to think about the politics of change and be producing messages which are useful at the right time to policymakers. That's a picture of Rasputin. I used to use Machiavelli, but Machiavelli looks too friendly and obviously likes children, and so I use Rasputin. The question I will often ask colleagues at ODI is this. You want to work on something, climate change or energy security, new actors, that's very good. Please tell me who is making what decision. When are they making the decision? What products do you need to influence the decision, and when do you need it? Five questions. Sometimes the product you need is a book. Sometimes the product you need is you're going to take Charles Michel out for lunch and explain to him how climate change policy should change over a lunch in Brussels or Strasbourg. We need to think about the policy process and how we use our research. In this project, we are going to invest a lot, I think, Jean-Luc, in the policy process, in producing workshops and 2 pages and 4 pages and websites that will communicate our findings. Of course, policymakers also need to behave differently. And when you look at this picture, an interesting question to ask is, which is the policymaker and which is the researcher? I think policymakers would like to think that the policymaker is on the left, calm, in control, obviously an intellectual because wears glasses, serious because wears a tie, whereas the researcher, who looks rather decrepit, is on the right, harassed, worried, late with the deadline, too many papers, is about to tear up yet another draft. But actually, you know what, I think it's the other way around. I think we need to be the researchers looking calm and in control, and the policymakers who are harassed. Actually, some of the thought to be women in this picture, but I couldn't find a picture of women. What am I trying to say here? That the relationship between researchers and policy makers requires a really intensive dialogue. If researchers need to behave differently, as I have suggested, then it's also true that policy makers need to behave differently. You need to tell us early on what your issues are. You need to be honest with us about the politics and not just about the technical content of the change processes that you're managing. You need to tell us whether we're being helpful or not all the way through this process. You need to make sure that going back to this network model, you're the people who are in our network who are bringing us up and telling us what you need. I think this project, EDC 2020, offers an opportunity to build an entirely new kind of relationship between researchers and policymakers. It's one that Louis Michel discussed when he and I were on the platform together at the Bonn Reality General Conference, and it's one we want to build on. I finished except to say that this is a collective project. It involves institutions right across Europe working together under the leadership of ERD. As Jean-Luc said, nearly 150 different research institutes, 3 or 4, taking the lead on this project, but building it into the wider community. DG Research, you have the opportunity here to tap into the biggest, most diverse, and most effective group of development researchers in the world. Researchers, we have the opportunity to tap in to the largest aid donor in the world. This is an extraordinary opportunity. Let's be clear about the exam question, which is really about how change happens in our European family. Let's use our research to deliver change in the future. Thank you.